Brooks. My show, Law and Disorder, is now on KPFK. Cutting-edge interviews with organizers, culture workers, newsmakers, and freedom fighters, the weekly state terror roundup, resistance in residence with artists using their gifts to change the world, and letters from the inside. That's just a small taste of what this show is about as we seek to expose, agitate, and build. Tune in Monday through Thursday at 8 a.m. on 90.7 or at kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
The scarlet standard high, beneath its walls we'll live and die. Though cowards cringe and trick a sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
Hi, I'm Mike Muratori, professional comedian. You're listening to People Powered KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. People ask me that all the time. I said I'd probably be some kind of criminal. My stepfather was a criminal. My brother's a criminal. I don't know. I mean, every job I've ever tried doesn't work. I'd probably do something really bad and be in jail. I've tried everything. Like, I was in finance. That was like a real job. That didn't work out.
Memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, all down.
Waiter walks up to the table. You ready to order? I'm so sad because the rainforest is vanishing. That's because you ate it. Well, you got the friend, right? All my friends, I'm Puerto Rican, Italian, and black. All my white friends have food allergies. Do you have a food allergy? Yes, you, no? Good, smart, no. Old, like, I'm old. There was no food allergies. Everybody's got food allergy now. We're out. My friend's like, I'm allergic to wheat, sugar, water, honey, air, sky, food. I'll have my pancakes steamed, blessed by God, on separate plates. Waiter, there's microorganisms in my water. I was like, no, there's not. The toxic lead killed them off. Drink up. I have a friend who's a vegan bodybuilder, right? He said he's going to beat me up. I said, you weigh 89 pounds. I feed you a potato chip. You're dead. Cause of death, Frito-Lay. You don't want that on your headstone.
That was a small sample of stand-up comedian Mike Muratori in this first Working Voices segment this morning. Executive producer Damra Corey speaks to the self-proclaimed serial killer of comedy about what it's like to work in comedy today.
Have you ever had a union job?
A union job? Yeah. I would never. I could never get into a union. How am I going to? What union am I going to do? The killing union? What union would I get into?
Screen Actors Guild.
I'm in the guild.
See,
I'm in the guild.
You are a union man.
Yeah, I'm in the guild. I actually activated my card. I had it forever from like since like 01, but I reactivated it. I don't know, like 6 months ago.
Oh, very good.
It's kind of useless. I mean, I work, but everything is non-union now. Unless you're a movie star, the card is useless. I think what's going to happen is all these unions are going to collapse soon. And people are just going to make individual deals. Like if they're famous, they're just going to make a deal with the production company. And that's going to be it, because SAG only works for like maybe 1% of the actors. It's like you're paying into something that you're never going to get anything out of unless you become famous. Then it's worth it because it covers like you get like full dental, full medical. You get a pension. I have a friend who has a pension. I have two friends that have pensions from SAG, actually. You have to make so much money a year for like so many years. And they have actually legit pensions. And it's pretty cool because one of them is a woodworker and he's on dialysis and he's a comic too. So I guess it pays for his dialysis and his Ozempic, because he takes Ozempic like once a week for his diabetes. And I don't think he could afford it if he didn't have that insurance, because Ozempic, I think for one shot, if you were to get it from a store, it's like it's over $600.
Wow.
And it's not for weight loss. For him, it's a miracle drug because they stick it in their stomach and they're set for the week. They don't need to take insulin the rest of the week.
Wow.
And that's the beautiful thing about it. And he lost a lot of weight from doing it. He went from about, I want to say 300 pounds to about 170.
Amazing. Have you gone overseas? How does your comedy play over there?
It did good. I went to England. I killed there. I went to Wales, Scotland, killed there. I tell you where I bombed. Ireland. They hated me in Ireland. Hated me. Started heckling. And I said, I'm going to tell you why I'm the serial killer of comedy. And this was 45 minutes of me heckling them back. I said, listen, you're just mad because the French stole your woman and the English stole your religion. This went on for 45 minutes. I just started railing on them. There was 300, maybe 400 people in the room. When I got through with them, there was about 50. And an IRA guy gives me my flight, gives me my tickets, my money. And back then I was doing a ton of drug. So he's like, well, you know, we could kill you. I go, I'm probably going to die of an overdose anyway before the night's out. So give me my money. And I was thrown out of the country. I was supposed to do a week. I did one night, thrown out of the country. So when people tell me about their bombs, they don't even know what a bomb is. Okay. I got stabbed on stage in Montebello, California. Stabbed in the arm. I'll show you. Maybe you can see it on the camera. The top one. See that?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I'm doing a show in Montebello, California, years ago. Ladies in the front. She had a tattoo. PPA. Stabbed me in the arm with a steak knife. Okay. The knife stick out. Sticking out like this, right? There's a bar, metal bar around the stage. She hits her head on the bar, flips over and cracks her head open. So the knife is sticking out of my arm, and I thought she hit an artery because I could feel how deep she went. So the paramedics come, and I go, did she hit an artery? They're like, no. So they're like wrestling with it. They pop it out. They stitch it. And I got money from the place, but yeah, I've had real bombs. People rush the stage. Then I was at another show where I'm doing a private party. This bodybuilder, high on steroids, rushes the stage. I whip him around and choke him out. I put him out. He takes me to court. So we go to court. The judge is like, Mr. Muratori, how tall are you? I go, 5'6", Your Honor. It was a woman. Mr. Johnson, how tall are you? He goes, 6'4". Let me get this straight, Mr. Johnson. We're here because you rushed the stage to assault Mr. Muratori. Mr. Muratori de-escalated the violence with a chokehold. Why are we here? Case dismissed. And he was just like, oh, and that was the end of that. But, oh, yeah, I've had some issues. People jump on. Like, now that I'm old, I don't do that. Like, if I see that you're going to come on stage, I just leave. Because I don't want an 8th assault charge. I beat 7. But, yeah, where I grew up, it was violent. You know, my mother was violent. My father was violent. My brother's violent. So I was raised in violence. Now I'm a lot mellower, you know, and I teach martial arts, too.
Interesting.
So I have a lot of restraint with people. I try to de-escalate. I'd be like, you really don't want to do that. You really don't want to hit me. You really don't want to do that. I'm just an old man. You don't want to hurt me. You don't want to do that. And you know, usually it works. I haven't had to hit anybody in real life in a long time, so.
You make comedy sound kind of scary.
Yeah, I mean, the places I play, all my teeth are fake now. See these? They're perfect, but they weren't like that when you met me. They were all jacked up. I had one broken in here from getting kicked. My best friend is my dentist. It helps to have a best friend as a dentist.
So do you have any more advice for up-and-coming comedians?
If you can do something else with your life, do that. Don't do stand-up. If this is really your calling, you're going to know. Because nothing else in your life will work but this. Not your relationships. I just got signed by this huge agency. They were hilarious. It was like a scene out of a movie. They were like, do you want to get married? I go, no. Why would I want to get married? Why would I ever want to do that again? Well, what do you want? Well, I want a house and a dog and maybe prostitutes. That's it. And just do my stuff. And they just started laughing because they were like, kind of like all that. They were like me. They're like, you don't want to get married again. For what? Why would I want to get married? I already did it. I already did all that. I want a dog. My family used to breed dogs. I really would like a dog. People go, what do you want? I really want a dog. You know, they're like, well, that's kind of a distraction. I'll get an assistant to take care of the dog. Like, that's my next purchase. I want to. I have a ton of dog breeder friends. So I'm either going to get a giant dog, like a Mastiff, or I'm going to get like a tiny dog, like a Bull Terrier. My friend breeds them. But I want to, people go, what do you want? I go, I want a dog. And the Huskies, the problem with them is they're bred to be in the cold. They don't do well in the heat,
right?
Because they have double coats. Yeah. People don't know this about Huskies. They have double coats. So even if you shave them down, there's still a coat that's really heavy underneath. Right. You have to shave the dog down to like baldness to like get to where they would be comfortable in the heat. First thing. Second thing is they can be vicious and they're hard to train. And they're escape artists. I know a lot about dogs. They are escape artists and they can destroy your house. If you get a good one and they like you and you can control them, that's great. But I have a friend, she got a rescue husky and it destroys her house. And I go, they're really hard to train. Yeah, people that do rescue, I love. So I have a lot of friends that do rescue. They do a lot of nice things for dogs.
Exactly.
So I have two friends that are deep into rescue. Would I own a rescue dog? No. I had one as a kid. I had a beagle and it bit me and I had to put it down. Like, we used to breed Dobermans and Great Danes. My stepfather bred Dobermans for, like, guard and attack. And we had Great Danes that they would use for pets and, like, show dogs. They would sell them. So I grew up with, like, giant dogs. I don't know if I'd want another big dog like that. I'm either going to get this Mastiff from my friend. My buddy just passed away, and he had this breeding program. So he gave the breeding program to our other friend. So my other friend breeds them now in the Ozarks. And he goes, I'll just give you a dog when you're ready. I'm like, all right. And then my other friend is breeding Bull Terriers in Pennsylvania, but he modified them. So they look like the old ones. They have like a long snout. And he's trying to shrink them down to like 16 pounds. He's got this idea. He wants to turn them into like a toy dog. He's got them down to 25 pounds now. And I kind of like the 25 pounder. I don't know if I'd be into like a tiny, tiny dog like that. But I told him, I said, if you can consistently shrink them down to like 16 to 20 pounds, you could sell them for out in L.A. for $2,000 to $4,000 each dog. Because they have a long snout. They're not like typical Bull Terriers. It's got a full snout and they're really athletic and they're real mellow. I said, how's the temperament? He goes, they're amazing. Because he added like a little bit of pit bull in there to kind of reactivate the old genes from like 60 years ago. So they look different. They look cool. And they're really nice. Like for a 25-pound dog, it's just it's a great dog. If you want something smaller, it's got like a lot of fire. Like it's like a fun dog. It's got like personality. So either one of those or both, if I have a lot of money, I'll buy two.
Is there anything you would like to add that we haven't... that I somehow missed.
I got a show on 11/14, 10 o'clock, the Comedy Store, the Belly Room. Tickets are online. Punchlines Only. Punchlines Only is the show in the Belly Room on 11/14, 10 o'clock upstairs.
And now that you're not doing drugs or alcohol, are you funnier, not as funny?
Way funnier, way sharper. But I tell people, I'm helping a friend get sober right now. I'm a sober coach. I do that at a love. My buddy called me on Saturday. One of my openers, really good friend of mine. I'm not going to say his name. And he's got, yeah, I'm way sharper sober. And I do sober coaching once in a while. I have a friend that's addicted to cocaine and alcohol. I'm trying to get him sober. And you could just see the, It's not good. Like, I'm trying to dry him out. Your comedy, in my opinion, there's a lot of famous people that are addicted to drugs and alcohol that are stand-up comedians. I can't say names. You know who they are. You can see them. They're around. The problem is, eventually, it'll kill you. Like, Richard Pryor was addicted to drugs. Ron White is a big drinker. I think he quit. It's hard because you get offered stuff all the time. You get off stage, you get offered cocaine, you get offered women, you get offered alcohol, free drinks. It took me this time I'm like able to control it now. Like I'm always driving people around and getting them sober, and you know, I'm like the designated driver now. I'm like the alcoholic voyeur, where I drive other people around if they're drunk, because I don't want them to get DUIs. But it took me in the beginning, the sixth time I got sober, the fifth time was bad. The sixth time I would sit outside the club. I wouldn't go in the club until they called me. Now, like, I'm cool. Like, I don't miss drugs. I used to smoke cigarettes. I don't do that.
It's often said that comedians, once they stop on the bad stuff, lose their edge.
They do if they don't get on stage all the time, because they're going to become, you're absolutely right. It's like a half truth. If they don't get up all the time, they will lose their edge. Absolutely. They'll become dull, because whatever made them alive from the drugs, Robin Williams, one of my favorite comics of all time. You know, people are like, somebody gave me a great compliment the other night. They're like, you're a combination of Don Rickles and Robin Williams. I said, that's pretty true, because both of them are my two favorite comics. And I got to see Don before he died. And I saw Robin perform a million times because my buddy used to open for him. And when Robin was on cocaine, Robin was unbelievable. And at the end, it was really sad. At the end, he had to make like $9 million a year net to maintain his lifestyle. How crazy is that? And he had some weird disease at the end. He had like
a form of Parkinson's.
Yeah, and he hung himself. He did it so his kids would get the rest of his money. Zach, his son, and the other one got all the money, because he still had some money left, but not much. I mean, he went from like $120 million to like maybe $20 million, you know? You know who he took care of? His best friend was Christopher Reeves. He paid for a lot of his medical. Wow. Like when he got messed up, they were roommates in Juilliard, and they made a pact that whoever made it first would take care of the other one. So when Christopher Reeves blew up ahead of him, he was helping him financially. And then when he got hurt, Robin was paying all his medical bills. That's what I heard. Like, it was an amazing thing. Like, people thought he was crazy, but he was literally bankrolling to keep his friend alive, because that's how close they were. I mean, Robin, he was amazing. He was like an angel. I mean, he stole jokes, but he could tell the jokes better than the people that were actually doing the jokes. He could take them to another level. He was like a genius. So when I used to watch him, I could see that he was taking other people's stuff, but he was mutated in a way where it was something else. It was like, he was like a jazz musician. He would just take it to another level. He was a genius, and he could act too. In my opinion, he was one of the best stand-up comics / actors ever. I say him. I say Eddie Murphy. Who else? That was like a really great comedian that could act. Those two, I would say, in my opinion, were the best, because a lot of comics can't act because they're just so, it's just a different animal. I started off as an actor. So it was like, I have a degree in theater, which is useless. So I got into stand-up backwards. Same thing with him. He went to Juilliard for acting and he quit. And then he got into improv, and then he got into stand-up. And a lot of actors are doing that now. They're going backwards because they can't get any work. So it's like they go into the reverse. But
yeah, you had talked about that earlier, about that only a few actors make enough money to subsist the pension. But are you worried about AI? Because they can take Asner, bring him back to life, and have him do 20 more movies.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not wealthy enough, rich enough, big enough to care about it. I was supposed to do something in the beginning of the year with AI, but they didn't want to pay me anything. It was ridiculous. I'm like, I'm not doing this. I just walked off of a set on Friday. Friday. I think I'm banned from the club because I walked out because the production was so bad. I was like, I'm not signing my life away and doing this. This is awful. I left. So I called the booker. And I said, am I banned? She goes, I don't think you're banned. She goes, you show up for your spot. If he throws you out, you live around the corner. I'm like, yeah, all right. So, yeah, I just shot a short film, what was it, a month ago? For Omari Hardwick's producing partner. He's my buddy. And they wrote me a part. I play a comic who hides a dead body. And they asked me off camera, they go, how do you hide a dead body? I go, do you really want to know how you hide a dead body? And they go, yeah. I go, well, you dig a ditch that's 9 feet deep. You put the body in it. You cover it with dirt. Then you take a dead animal and you put it on top of that. And then you cover that and it'll throw the dogs off. I mean, I went into detail because I did use a premedicine. I can show you how to get rid of a dead body. And they're like, really? I said, yeah, I grew up with criminals, real ones. And I did use a pre-med. If I was to do it, I would dissolve the body. I wouldn't put it in a ditch. I would put it in a vat of acid. But think about digging a 9 foot deep hole. Think about how hard that would be to do. But I knew, I'm not going to name names, but I knew guys that did stuff like that. They'd bulldozer a 9 foot ditch and then people would just disappear.
Well, this has certainly been an interesting interview.
Yeah.
Mike Muratore, and I hope to see you very soon. And keep on making a slam.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you soon. I'll send you the video.
That was Working Voices executive producer Damer Corey in an interview with stand-up comedian Mike Muratore. For more information on Mike Muratore, he can be found at mikemuratore.com.
Raise the scarlet standard high. Beneath its walls we'll live and die. Though cowards cringe and trick a sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
Hi, I'm Mike Muratore, professional comedian. You're listening to People Powered KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
In this week's Working Voices update on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, we go to Red Star Report's own Reggie Wong for interviews from the November 6th UTLA rally in Wilmington.
Hi, this is Reggie Wong with KPFK's Working Voices. And I'm here, and we're here actually at this UTLA rally in Wilmington, California. And I'm here speaking to Phyllis Hoffman. Hey, Phyllis, introduce yourself, please.
Hi, my name is Phyllis Hoffman. I am a teacher librarian at Harry Bridges Span School. I am also UTLA's Harbor Area Chair, representing about 3,100 UTLA members from San Pedro to the very southern tip of Watts.
Okay, and what? And now I understand there's rallies like this all over Los Angeles today. What's the purpose of these rallies?
Our purpose in these rallies is, first of all, there are 8 LA Unified unions that work for the Los Angeles Unified School District, and we have a healthcare bargaining team composed of representation from all 8 units. And we are fighting with the district for our healthcare benefits, because they want to make changes that are ultimately going to hurt our members and cost us money out of our own pockets. And this is at a time when healthcare should be a human right, and our members depend on getting their healthcare benefits. Like when I was hired way back in the day, I was promised healthcare benefits for life. And that's something that they're trying to cut. So the district's got a $5.3 billion reserve. And that's another reason we're out here, because we know the district has the money. They're just not making it a priority to spend it on employees.
What have working conditions been like recently, or like without a good contract?
Superintendent Carvalho, and I've been in the district for 28 years now, he is the most authoritarian superintendent I have ever encountered. He believes in top-down model, where he dictates to teachers, like, you have to do this assessment and this assessment. You got to progress monitor these kids and those kids. And teachers always come last. I know if you listen to his remarks about LA Unified's rising test scores, he thanked everybody, and then the teachers got thanked last, when we are the ones closest to the students who are making gains because of our members that are working in our schools.
And what do the schools really need?
We need time to collaborate with each other and plan. Especially elementary school teachers are fighting for preparation time during their school day. We need less top-down management. We need to be trusted that we are the professionals that we are. You know, we have credentials from the state of California. We need more mental health supports for our students. We still need more nurses in our schools. We need, when I say mental health, we need psychiatric social workers, our pupil accounting, PSA counselors. We need school counselors. We need a whole plate of mental health services for our students. And those workers need smaller caseloads so that they can give the one-on-one attention that students need.
Can you tell me some of the demands that are on the table right now?
So we have, one of our biggest demands is we have asked for a revised salary schedule where we, the teachers, as a bargaining team of over 140, our union leadership presented to us like, hey, we think this would be a really good salary schedule because, first of all, it would bump up new teacher salaries to $80,000 a year. Teachers could get fully like into the salary schedule at 70 units. Right now it takes 99, the equivalent of 3 master's degrees. We are also asking for healthy, clean, and green schools, which we got a TA on. We are asking for LGBTQIA supports and protections for students and educators, which we also reached an agreement on. And we are also asking for, and what they're dragging their heels on, and it is breaking my heart, our protection for our immigrant educators and students. And right now, we also have no clear definitions, like when should schools be shut down because there's ICE activity in the neighborhood?
I guess, are you referring to like what happened to Santee High School?
Absolutely that. There was still ICE in the neighborhood. Not only that, we also got reports from Union del Barrio that there were snipers on the roof protecting the ICE agents and DSHS agents. What do you think that does to a kid who's in their like algebra class? Do you think they're going to be able to learn? And the principal was refusing to lock down.
Can you explain to some of the listeners that aren't aware of the incident, like what happened at Santee High School recently?
As far as I understand, there is a community member named Richard L.A. who has a history of documenting ICE activity in that area. He is very well known. And they know, and ICE knows who Richard L.A. is. So they tried to grab him. He tried to flee. They blocked his car. And the next thing you know, somebody fired something. Richard was injured. I think one of a marshal might have been injured. And that's when all the police activity just escalated to the nth degree.
ICE is detaining students, including Benjamin over at Reseda High School. Can you mention something about, do you know any developments on Benjamin's predicament?
I do know that the Community Self-Defense Coalition, along with Union del Barrio and some educators, they had a press conference on Monday afternoon to call for the release of Benjamin. And he still hasn't been released. I believe he's still at the Adelanto detention facility. And at this point, I feel like we really need to take action on Benjamin's part, whether that's we start flooding the school board or if the district would pass our immigrant supports and education for immigrant students and educators. One thing we have in there is that students would not be detained by ICE, that they would be released and allowed to go back to school. And so he's a high school senior, and this is 4 months now.
So what other protections would this immigrant protections?
Well, I think most importantly is when there is ICE activity close to the school, the first step in the protocol after it's been confirmed is that this school should be locked down. So when I say locked down, that means that no people can come in or out, right? And then the second thing is to also provide legal help to our DACA educators and legal help to like families and, you know, or law clinics as well. And we also want what we call more dream centers open where they can get resources for families.
Tell us about the recent agreement for protections for LGBTQ plus students.
Well, so I think many people may not know, but there was recently the Supreme Court did a ruling on Mahmoud versus Taylor, which basically like gives parents the right to opt out of stories that feature LGBTQIA characters. And so we want clear guidance that teachers will be protected if parents complain. Again, more legal supports, you know, especially around doxing educators, sharing like where they live. You know, we've had educators that have been bullied by the public because of who they are, and that is just wrong. So hopefully this agreement will help us give these protections, like put some teeth behind it.
Great. And if the public wants to get involved, or how can the public help support the UTLA?
I think the best way is that they can go to our website, utla.net.
So this is
Phyllis Hoffman
and Reggie Wong with this Working Voices update.
Bye. Thank you.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and on the web at kpfk.org.
This is Working Voices, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and to the rest of the world at kpfk.org.
And now, we return to Reggie Wong in this Working Voices update with more from the UTLA rally in Wilmington from November 6th.
This is Reggie Wong with this Working Voices update for KPFK. We're at the UTLA rally in Wilmington. It's part of a series of rallies throughout Los Angeles for teachers in the LAUSD school district. And I'm here with Monica. Monica, can you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, I'm Monica Caballero. I am a UTLA Harbor Area Board Director. I'm the Immigrant Justice Team Lead for our area, and I'm also a special education teacher in my area. So happy to be here to speak with you.
Can you tell us, what is this rally about?
Yeah, so right now we are in the midst of bargaining with LAUSD, and we are bringing the heat right now. We are showing that we are serious about our demands, our bargaining demands. We have demands ranging from immigrant protections to LGBTQIA plus protections for students and educators who are being targeted and harassed. Similarly, we're seeing this among our immigrant population. So we need the district to know that we are here. We see what's happening. They are not doing enough to protect us, and that we demand more. We demand better treatment. In addition to that, we're out here fighting to protect our own livelihood as well. But of course, everything goes back to our students, what's best for them, and how we can support them. So I know I'm out here, and my colleagues are all out here to fight for what's right for us, for our students, for our communities, for parents, everyone that is impacted by all that we do.
And how has the community support been so far?
This is fantastic. I mean, you can hear all the honking in the background. We're in the heart of Wilmington, which is very much a union town. People here see our work. They know that we're here to protect their students and that we love our students. And there's definitely a lot of positive energy right now, a lot going on. So it's definitely a lot of community support.
Any groups in particular that have been very helpful?
Oh, absolutely, yes. As an immigrant justice team lead, I've had the privilege of connecting with organizations like Community Self-Defense Coalition, with Union del Barrio, that did help us facilitate an educator patrol training, with Harbor Area Peace Patrol, who's been an amazing partner and ally in all this work. I know that they are helping us by patrolling our school sites in addition to, you know, local community spots, and my heart just goes out to everyone doing this work. And also, I want to shout out my colleagues that have also stepped up to set up educator patrols through our sanctuary team policy. So as an organization within UTLA, we do have a sanctuary team work that's going on. We're facilitating trainings for our educators, for our community members, and encouraging our members to also get out on the streets and protect their communities as well.
Now, you've been talking about, like, the schools need protection. Can you tell us, what are the biggest threats right now in local education?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is immigration, right? As Immigration Justice Team Lead, our student safety. I'm sure you heard about a situation at the Santee Education Complex where immigration officials engaged in live fire right by the entrance of a high school where students were present. And it is absolutely unacceptable for that to happen. Someone was injured, and we are so thankful that it wasn't one of our students or one of our staff members, but it is unacceptable for this activity to be going on, well, period, but also so close to our campuses. Our students deserve to feel safe. Our students organized. They came together to fight back and tell the district they do not feel safe knowing that this activity is occurring right outside the gates of their schools. We need to have stronger sanctuary policies and languages in place to make sure that our students are being protected.
There have been other incidents where they've gone out in front of schools and apprehended people, right? And I think they did apprehend a LAUSD student as well.
Right. Yeah, they're terrorizing our communities. They should not be conducting any of this activity anywhere near our school sites. And that is a policy that I would, ambitiously love to see implemented. We have the ability to call for lockdowns when there is police enforcement out in the community. They are supposed to notify our schools. I don't know why it would be any different for these federal officers.
What other protections or other actions are needed to help immigrant students thrive and make sure they're able to, continue their education without interruptions?
Definitely having uniform district policies to ensure everyone's safety. So that's what we are pushing for and advocating right now. At the end of the day, that's why we have the work and language that we proposed for bargaining. And that's what we're fighting for everyone's safety.
What else do the schools need?
The district is trying to say that they do not have the money to fund our schools, to fund the programs. I'm a special education teacher, to fund the services that our students need, and that is absolutely a lie. Our board member, Tanya Ortiz Franklin, she hosted a budget analysis, forum for the community, and she did present a question which said, which would you prefer, eliminating teaching positions or increasing class sizes? And that is a signal, an attempt to strike fear into our communities when we know that the district has billions of dollars in their reserves that they could tap into to fund all of these programs that we need.
And what have conditions been like lately at schools? I mean, you got ICE agents, and it sounds like there's issues with teaching LGBTQ plus other issues, like international issues. I heard that teachers are getting put under a microscope for that.
Yeah, the passage of AB 715 or SB 715. Sorry, I can't think off the top of my head. People are very much concerned that teachers are going to be targeted for their academic freedom, right? So I know that my colleagues are, righteous, moral people, and that they would not do anything to harm their students. And the passage of this recent legislation is, again, creating an opportunity for people to put them under a microscope and challenge them for their, based on their personal beliefs or personal perception of what they think someone is doing. And obviously, that is a concern for academic freedom.
And how can the community get involved?
Contact your local through United Teachers Los Angeles. We do have chapter chairs at our local sites, right? So if you go to your local site, you should be able to connect with the UTLA representative. See what needs are people have locally, and then on the bigger, on the bigger scale, in the grand scheme of things, be out here with us, right? At this rally right now, we do have community members who are participating. People even just driving by and honking their horn, everything helps. Every little bit helps.
So this is Reggie Wong.
And Monica Caballero.
For this Working Voices update. Thank you so much.
No, we love you, we appreciate you, and we need your support.
Thank you.
Darkness with our light.
You're listening to Working Voices on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
This week, Steve Zelser from his Labor Video YouTube channel has an interview with Becky McLean, a molecular biologist at Pfizer Laboratories. She has become a biohazard whistleblower and written about her experience in a new book called Exposed, A Pfizer Scientist Battles Corruption, Lies, and Betrayal.
This is Steve Zelser, and today we're going to be talking with Becky McLean, who is a molecular biologist. She was working at Pfizer in Groton, Connecticut, and she's just finished a book after a long struggle to get it written called Exposed, A Pfizer Scientist Battles Corruption, Lies, and Betrayal and Becomes a Biohazard Whistleblower. So welcome to our show, Becky.
Thank you, Steve. It's nice to see you again.
So, Becky, why don't you talk about being a molecular biologist? You began to work at Pfizer, and that was an important event for you in your career. They have a large number of scientists there. What was it like working at Pfizer when you first came there?
Well, when I first began my work at Pfizer, I had around 17 years of experience in the lab. So I was a very skilled molecular biologist. And coming to Pfizer was a fantastic thing. The first 5 years I worked on vaccine technologies and research and development. And it's when I started working in an embryonic stem cell laboratory, working with technologies that could change one's genome, animal genome or human genome, that things changed completely. And I began to see some very poor biosafety practices that were a public concern.
And you had a serious problem in your laboratory that raised concern about your safety and the safety of other fellow workers. And you tried to raise that. Why don't you talk about the biological cabinet, the leak, and your effort to get it repaired?
Which problem did you want me to talk about? Okay, well, this was after we raised several issues and they were ignoring it. After ignoring our safety complaints and not having a venue to get them addressed, we started falling ill with exposures. And one of the exposures was from a biosafety biocontainment cabinet. Now, these cabinets are used, you've seen them on TV, where a scientist has their hands inside a big cabinet with a glass facade or face. And you usually use infectious agents in there, or biologics that you need to keep sterile, or cell cultures to protect you and the environment from escaping, or to keep them just sterile. So after so many years in my career, all of a sudden, this noxious odor was coming into the lab and we couldn't figure out what was going on. And it was immediately within 10 minutes making us sick with nausea, headaches.
This is pretty serious. You're working with dangerous materials. I mean, it sounds like an emergency. And the idea that you've been contaminated with something, you're sick, other people in the laboratory have been getting sick in your laboratory, and you can't even find out what the material is. You request the material from them contaminated with, and they won't tell you. They said
that's right. And that's called an exposure record. And by law, workers are supposed to get their exposure records. If you're exposed to a virus, you have to know the identity of that virus, especially a genetically engineered virus, because that's going to be a novel virus. No, if you go to the doctor, no doctor is going to have a test for a genetically engineered virus, right? So you have to get your exposure records. And one of the exposure records is the most important is the complete genetic sequence of the virus, because then you can have that analyzed, and there are molecular programs that can tell you basically what the virus has been cloned and created to do. So they wouldn't give that to me, and I had to fight. That's one of the reasons why I had to go to the OSHA. I also went to OSHA, of course, to tell them to please go into my department. I see, you know, people are afraid to lose their jobs and they're working in an unsafe environment. Go into my department and you're going to see we don't have a break room. That's so obvious. And they refused to go in and do an inspection. And they had documents of multiple complaints from multiple scientists.
Well, OSHA, which is supposed to be protecting our health and safety, the health and safety of workers in the United States, knew about the fact that there was a leak, there were contaminants at Pfizer in your laboratory, that people were actually getting sick. This is a systemic, serious problem in the laboratory. And they refused to go to that laboratory to find out what was going on.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I tried to have them assist me to get my exposure records, because, again, that is under law, that employees have a right to their exposure records. And they ruled eventually that trade secrets supersedes my right, which Pfizer had ruled. Pfizer said, I'm not giving you this information because trade secrets supersede your rights. Now, exposure records aren't just they're records that are necessary for your health, for your medical care, and for your well-being. So here I have this company telling me, sorry, trade secrets supersede your right. And so this issue went all the way up to Washington, D.C., and OSHA ruled that trade secrets supersedes my right.
What happened at OSHA? They wouldn't do a visit to the laboratory to find out what's going on. And also, apparently, they took your documents, which you had given to them, and copied them, and known to you, they gave them to Pfizer.
Yes. Well, here's the bizarre thing. The investigator called me up, and she said three times, please bring your attorney documents with you. And I thought, why would the OSHA, I immediately felt uncomfortable because attorney-client documents are privileged and they're private. You're talking to your attorney about, what's going on and you're trying to figure out what's whatever. But she said, I only need them because of dates to make sure or something that you had gone to. I don't know what her, I can't remember. So I did bring them. I didn't give them to her. We discussed some dates that I found an attorney and I, put the date that I said, let me see. That was the first day I went to the whatever questions. At lunchtime after the meeting, I had all my books in my hand. I was going to bring them down to my car, lock them up for lunch, then bring them back because these were private documents. I wanted them in my safekeeping. And when I was leaving the room, the investigator said, Becky, that's just too much for you to carry. Listen, I promised you I'm going to lock them up in this room. No one's going to touch them, blah, 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 And so I thought, okay. She seemed trustworthy. So I kept them in the room, came back an hour later. And when I came back, she said, she held up a manila envelope saying, here are the documents you gave me that I could copy. I had given her some documents and I knew what was in the, because we were discussing them when we were having the interview. So I had put them in a manila envelope and I gave it to her. When I came back, it was thicker than the initial, manila. And then she quickly changed subject because I looked at it. I'm like, hey, that looks thicker than what I gave her. And she said, this is what you gave me. And then she changed subjects and she said, you've got a really good case. And then now she's changed. Well, what happened is that she copied my attorney client privilege documents when I was gone and put them in 52 pages in my OSHA file. So she stole them. That OSHA file went to Pfizer. I mean, this is how it's unbelievable how you're trusting a government agency to do what's right. And it's just full of deceit, pro-corporation, trying to be a partner with Pfizer to hide.
She was literally an agent for Pfizer.
Well, she wasn't an agent for workers, that's for sure.
And so later on, you actually wanted an investigation of what happened, how they stole your files, how they ended up with Pfizer. And you met with David Michaels, the head of OSHA. Why don't you talk about that visit you had with him?
Okay, no, I didn't win OSHA. OSHA dismissed my case and wouldn't go in for an inspection, wouldn't help me with my exposure records, getting the sequence of the virus so I can get medical care. And then she closed the case and said, wouldn't give me an excuse of she wouldn't really tell me why she was closing the case after a year. And then I found out after I was able to finally get my file because she still wouldn't give me the file. She said you could appeal the case, which I did. But I said, how can I appeal the case when you're not telling me why you're throwing it out? Well, you don't know that information. I can't give you that information. So I finally, after I appeal, and then I lost on the appeal. And remember, I don't know how they're making decisions because they're not telling me anything. And I finally have to FOIA my file to understand why they fired me. And she put that I was out to get money, that I had filed a OSHA complaint to get money when people were falling down ill in the lab, when there were biocontainment issues. See, they just wanted to silence me.
They wanted to shut you down. Here you have a situation where a worker who is contaminated and other people contaminated goes to an OSHA official, and that OSHA official takes the documents that you give, illegally copies some of your documents, and then helps provide those documents to Pfizer, the company that you're fighting to get your records. And you are faced with a situation in which the agency, which is supposed to protect you and workers, is actually working with the employer, the company, against you. And you did go to David Michaels at that time under Obama, yeah, who was the head of OSHA in the United States, to ask him, can you do something about this?
Yes. So I think I went to David Michaels, the head of OSHA, after I won the lawsuit. I think it was after I won the lawsuit, or was close to that point, because I was very angry that they had really denigrated my good name. I did not go to OSHA because I wanted money. There was a serious issue, and I was sick also. So I went to David Michaels to try to get the information about what was going on, because when I did receive my file, it was all my paperwork and two pages from Pfizer that were not, there was nothing in there that was credible enough that an investigator could have easily investigated and said, no, this is not right. Hold on. So, and then there was no inspection. No, her inspection report wasn't there of how she came about to this decision that I was out to get money. So it was just a charade. It was a charade.
What did David Michaels say? Did you ask him?
Well, I did, but then he never invested. I wrote him a letter. Hey, there's nothing here. Where's her file of investigation?
There's actually what I would say criminal collusion.
After 10 years, I kept fighting. So,
and you know, they thought they would destroy you. The book you talk about, your whole body freezing. You know, you're in terror because of this disease you have. They won't give you the information about it. And then you tried to get a lawyer. You tried to go to court. You couldn't get a lawyer. You go to court and you get a judge who says you shouldn't raise the issue of public health and safety, public health, at your trial.
Yes, she said I couldn't say the words public health and safety because it would prejudice the jury.
It would prejudice the jury.
Pfizer sure got to say whatever they wanted to. See, the issue was at that time, a big movement to work on human embryos in the laboratory work was occurring. And it's big money. It's big money. I mean, you know, from California, it's like $3 billion a year they put into human embryonic stem cells, paid by the residents of California. So I don't want to get into the politics too much of what happened, but all the federal funding was stopped under Bush. And so the movement went to states. Each state was to be targeted that their residents pay for human embryonic stem cells, which the controversy was you have to destroy the embryo. To do the work, you have to destroy the embryo. Of course, it's controversial, but it's a hard story to swallow.
It's a hard story, but it's a true story. And it's a story that these companies and the government really don't want you to know about, because that's who you were fighting, the media and the government, to get your story out. And when you won your case, small little thing in the New York Times, no follow-up. CBS, you know, the 60 Minutes could have done a whole story. But of course, yes. CBS is taking money from Pfizer. So obviously.
Oh, they're all taking money. And the NPR, too. I thought NPR, you know, oh, they're going to take my story. No, because they were telling the story about how wonderful human embryonic stem cell research was. And they had weekly, oh, it's so just wonderful, wonderful. But when I would call them, hey, wait, hold on, we have an alternate. Hush, hush.
Corporatization of the media.
Corporatization. You
know, I mean, having companies give money and decide, I mean, they'll decide what the media is going to say.
It's just unbelievable.
And the whole drug industry, they control the government.
It appears that way, doesn't it?
It's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
And in your case is the prime example, because you went to government agencies and they basically, in the case of OSHA, conspired against you to help Pfizer. So
yep.
That is really what comes out clearly in your book. And I think every worker, every person in this country is concerned about public safety, concerned about science and having the true facts about what's going on in our society, that they have the right to do that. And your book explains exactly how it's not working for the people of this country, for scientists,
yes,
like yourself and others.
Thank you for really acknowledging that, because I don't want people to think it's just about me, a story, someone, you know, whistleblower. The book shows a bigger picture about what's going on, and it's very important.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us. We've been talking with Becky McLean, a molecular biologist, a scientist at Pfizer who saw that there were some serious health and safety problems, reported, got sick, and then had a long battle war to defend herself, protect her life, Pfizer, and win successfully in a lawsuit against Pfizer, and actually come out with a book that wasn't covered by an NDA, preventing her from telling her story. So thanks for joining us on Work Week.
Thank you, Steve. It's great seeing you.
That was Steve Zelser from his Labor Video YouTube channel. For videos and insights from Steve Zelser, you can go to his Labor Video YouTube channel, or now you can find him at the Production of Labor Video Project on the web at www.labormedia.net. And for more information about Becky McLean, you can find her new book, Exposed, on Amazon.com and in bookstores.
And that's our show for this week. We're asking our labor partners, locals, and regional officers to consider underwriting this show. Working Voices and KPFK could really use your support. Please contact the station at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org to explore the possibilities. We want to hear from you. Email your comments or questions to workingvoices@aol.com. Please contribute if you can at 818-985-5735. Once again, this is Joe Ayala, president of NABIT CWA Local 53, along with Kay Michael, Enrique Sanchez. Our special thanks to Dan McCrory, Steve Zelter, Gary Scott, Hal Lohr, and our guests. Please remember to give what you can to keep us going. We're in this together. Remember to
educate, agitate, and organize.
Have a great week, everybody.
And hello, my name is Stephanie Sosi. I am Dinette of the Navajo Nation and Mayan. I invite you to listen to Ancestral Contact every Monday, 10:30 to 11:30 on KPFK. Yate she Stephanie Sosi when she Dinette Mayan Nishle. Ehehe, das Nolts on Ancestral Contact KPFK.
Give
give a gift to KPFK and yourself when you let us take your unwanted vehicle off your hands. Not only will your donation help support the on-air programs our community relies on every day, but you even qualify for a tax deduction. Go to kpfk.org/cars or call 877-573-5288. That's 1-877-KPFK-AUTO to learn more.
La agencia ICE está intensificando las operaciones de deportación en el área de Los Ángeles. Pero si lo detienen agentes de la ICE, usted tiene derechos constitucionales sin importar su estatus migratorio. Si usted o alguien que conoce ha sido detenido o desea denunciar a la ICE, puede obtener más información en CHIRLA, llamando al 888-624-4752 para obtener ayuda legal y